How much do you guys follow what the royals are up to? Like, what is your level of royal engagement? Alex, are you abreast?
Well, I am now. I mean, isn't the name of the person Duchess like Chodlerodlilo or something?
I think it's pronounced Chumley. It's like
that's it.
It's spelled
all those consonants just lead to
Chalodmonlilo
exactly.
or something. So we're speaking, of course, about Lady Rose Hanbury, nay Hanbury, now Chumley. She's a bird-like aristo who has been rumored to be carrying on an affair with William.
Those letters equal Chumley is what you're telling me. Can I just spell out
yes,
the
please,
letters here?
Please do.
C-H.
Yes.
O. Okay. Little bit of an eyebrow raise there for me. Then we get an L. M-O-N-D-E-L-E-Y.
Chalmondeley.
And that's Chumley.
Oh, boy. Welcome to Critics at Large, a podcast from The New Yorker. I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
And I'm Vincent Cunningham. What's up, guys?
Hello.
Good to see you again.
Greetings.
Happy spring.
Happy spring. That's right. each week on this show, we make sense of what's happening in the culture right now and how we got here. And today we want to talk about a very troubling form of storytelling that has become rampant, especially online. Strangely, though, the best way to kind of isolate it is to talk about the royals. You know, they have had, I want to point out, a tough time of things in the last couple of months.
There are two royal health scares this morning with Princess Kate and King Charles both needing hospital treatment.
King Charles III announced recently that he's battling cancer. And then last Friday,
we have just learned some breaking news from Kensington Palace in London.
Kate Middleton, Catherine, Princess of Wales, released a video saying that she also is battling a cancer diagnosis.
It has been an incredibly tough couple of months for our entire family, but I've had a fantastic medical team who have taken great care of me, for which I'm so grateful.
Today we're not so interested in this announcement, but more in what's been going on leading up to it. This health update came after months of speculation online.
Kate has disappeared. We haven't seen Kate since actually December last year.
Conspiracy theories over Princess Kate and the royal family photo keep getting piled higher and higher.
Right.
What the hell is going on here? What is it?
And if you've been following this at all, you've probably heard a hodgepodge of things, something about a doctored photo.
Yeah, there was a doctored photo, of course. There were a couple of other photos that were extremely grainy, where people were, like, suspicious that it was even Kate. They were like, is it Pippa, her sister? Is it, like, a wax statue?
Right, like body doubles,
yeah.
Affairs, rumors of affairs, marital unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
Is she dead even? Where is Kate Middleton?
Yeah.
As if she had been sort of abducted. To be transparent with you listeners, we had decided to talk about this phenomenon even before Kate's medical announcement. But the horrible news does sort of heighten the absurdities and the dangers, I think, of something that we're seeing a lot these days. This impulse in certain quickly assembled communities online to essentially write their own reality into existence. In the absence of information, or even sometimes in spite of information that does actually exist, they create a scarily thorough parallel track to what is often, you know, a very serious reality. I think there's a big paradox at work here. The social internet, whose great promise, I think we can all say it's a failed promise at this point, but the promise is greater access to credible information. It's instead become an engine for widespread fictions. And they masquerade as the truth. And the glaring question is, where does that leave reality? So that's today on Critics at Large, the communal fictions of the online world. Okay, so let's dig into this Kate Middleton saga. I think all of us are kind of perhaps chastened, our mood is a little bit more somber given what we now know, which is that she's dealing with a very serious health issue, which makes these waves of speculation, as I said, kind of even more unhinged and dangerous and insensitive. But Nomi, for those of us who weren't really following this whole thing from the start, could you bring us up to speed? Take us back.
So Princess Kate, right, has always been a model royal, let's say. There has never been a hint of her seeking to abandon her duties, you know, not appearing where she was supposed to appear. So, you know, it was kind of a surprise after, you know, the last time anybody saw her in public was Christmas Day. She went to church with William and their three children. And then in January, Kensington Palace released an announcement saying Kate is having abdominal surgery in London, and she will return to public duties after convalescing around Easter time. Okay. And it was one of those announcements where it was like, okay, end of story. You know, no further questions. But then people were starting to say, okay, like, where is she? Like, we're hearing nothing.
We haven't seen
her.
Okay,
we haven't seen her. We haven't heard of her. People were getting really suspicious. And so the palace obviously was like, okay, people aren't just going to, you know, sit and rest easy knowing that Kate will return.
Based on what we've said.
Based on what we've said. And so for what's known in England as Mothering Day, which for some reason, I don't know, delights me, that term.
It's more active. It's like
It's like
day for all
I appreciate that as opposed to just Mother's Day.
Yeah, no, I like it. I like it.
In hearing, in it's, identity, but in action.
It's a job.
Right. It's a job. It's a job. So that was March 10th. They released a picture. Supposedly taken by William of Kate and the three children.
This is really important, right? This becomes a text.
Now, this is when all hell broke loose.
Can you describe the picture?
Yeah, okay. So we have Kate sitting down, wearing kind of jeans and kicky boots and a sweater. And the kids are also kind of nicely but casually dressed around her. You know, honestly, it looks like a JCPenney catalog.
That's right.
Saturated, you know, from color, the 80s. A little bit of green behind, and obviously nice house behind them.
Yeah, of course. It's like a picture of domestic bliss.
So what could be wrong with it?
No, okay, so then people started going in and being like, okay, something is weird here. Like, there are several areas where you see kind of like visual tells that suggested that there was a work of tinkering here and not apparently very well done tinkering.
Yeah, I mean, once you to give credit to the sleuths, you know, you can't unsee the flaws once they've been pointed out to you.
You can't unsee the flaws, and people have been trained in this type of what we're calling sleuthing by, you know, at least the last 10 years of the internet, where, for instance, you know, on Instagram especially, Instagram is full of kind of like Photoshop or Facetune fail accounts, right? Where it's like, oh my God, look, she kind of like made her waist slimmer, but in the process, the kind of the picture frame behind her has also become kind of like wavy. And so this is what started happening with this picture.
First here, it appears there was some editing around Princess Charlotte's sleeve. The area where the skirt and sweater sleeve meet don't seem to align quite right. Second, here, the area where the Princess of Wales hair and zipper meet seems to be modified as well. You can see a line, which can indicate that the image was photoshopped.
So the first thing that I immediately noticed was his hands. His left hand is like crossed and almost has like half a knuckle on a weird step thing. To me, immediately AI. Then his other hand.
You're a photographer. You take photos of families all the time. What am I missing here? What is this Photoshop fail?
So I want to draw your attention first to Kate's hairline. We see a bit of blurriness around George's chin, so that shows that they've gone in there to make her hairline look a bit fuller.
Okay.
And then if we go over to Lou Boy, I mean, Kate's hand is really blurred out, so that gives us an indication that there's been some Photoshopping and some stitching. And then...
Okay, so the photograph thing was a fail, obviously.
And they released a statement saying it was Kate who had died. Kate
did. Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Like,
so
sorry.
So Kate tweeted, like many amateur photographers, I do occasionally experiment with editing. right? And signed it C for Catherine, right? So that just like, you know, brought things up to the next level in terms of the suspicions of people. What is going on here? Like, is she dead? You know, is she cheating on William? Is William cheating on her? Does she have a secret baby that's not William's? Is he beating her? Is she getting, like, plastic surgery?
I never wanted to get into this theory because it's so dark, it's so serious, it's so real. And tragically, the evidence is overwhelming. So let's talk about it. 2 months before Kate was last seen on Christmas, she was pictured here visiting a prison at a planned engagement with mysterious wraps around her fingers. I'll be direct. The fears are that Kate did not sustain these injuries to her fingers when she was playing on the trampoline with her kids, but while she was experiencing the symptoms of an eating disorder.
Have the Swifties tried to find Kate Middleton? Have we asked them? Because I think if anybody was going to do it, they're the ones.
But apparently the affair with Rose Hanbury, it never stopped. And Rose Hanbury right now is pregnant with William's baby, and she's keeping it. And the ambulances that were seen leaving Sandringham right after Christmas were taking Kate, who was having a complete mental breakdown. You guys, doesn't it make sense? She's not getting on Zoom. She's not giving us that 5 seconds because she stopped cooperating. She is done.
What happened to her? You know, did she abscond to the Southern Hemisphere? Was she getting a BBL?
Oh, yeah. The only thing
Brazilian butt lift for those not familiar with the term. And then there was a video of William and Kate at a farmer's stand. And people were very suspicious and were like, okay, this doesn't look like Kate at all. Is this even her? I mean, Andy Cohen tweeted, that ain't Kate.
Andy Cohen of Bravo.
Andy Cohen of Bravo fame.
The Housewives impresario.
Yeah, the impresario who knows a lot, obviously, about famous women and kind of like speculation. And I, you know, I mean, honestly, I had to agree with him. It didn't look like her. Finally, on March 22nd, the palace apparently came to the end of their rope and were like, okay, we're going to come clean with the public. A video where Kate is sitting on a bench, staring at the camera, very gently and, you know, in an articulate way, recounting what has been going on with her, was released to sort of like put the kind of wrap up all of the speculations and everything.
We hope that you'll understand that as a family, we now need some time, space, and privacy while I complete my treatment. My work has always brought me a deep sense of joy, and I look forward to being back when I'm able. But for now, I'm
at the beginning of your wonderful outlay, Nomi, amazing, you talked about Kate as a model royal. And this is part of what I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
The royals understand themselves as actors in a story.
Yeah.
You know, as a narrative. And so what it means to be a good royal is to be present and to be legible.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of the slipperiness happens when one of those sort of functions is not performed. What is new, though, and that, I guess that's been the case forever, you know, you know, a bad royal is the one who doesn't want to be around or go to the Christmas mass or whatever, you know, right?
Sure.
That's old. What's new is that there's a rival function that can play out online where people can, I don't know, play fantasy and create whole theories that are based on evidence that are grounded in a kind of critique of images, of communications, of documents, you know, all weaponized toward the creation of an alternate fiction. This is what's so...
so interesting.
Troubling. Alex.
Okay. I have a few things to say about this.
Yes.
The first thing, Vincent, I don't know if it's new. It's new in this form. But for instance, what if you want to just stay in the realm of the palace and the English monarchy, look at what happened with King Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. Basically, a rumor was spread, a rumor was created at the highest levels, and it did matter that people believed it in order to, you know, get this wife of the king under the sword of an executioner.
Right.
That she had cheated on him, that she was an interloper, you know, all these kinds of rumors that were being spread around.
Mm-hmm.
So this is old palace stuff, speculation, and this kind of narrative building about what's going on. The other thing I do want to say, and this kind of goes back to the Henry VIII stuff, is this is not, you know, I think right now that there are two prime candidates for culprits. One is us and one is them. And they're both legit in the
100%.
Wrong. 100%.
Yeah. Like, and one depends on the other, crucially.
The us, of course, is the public, the English public, but more broadly, the global public and the online public, fundamentally, creating the hysteria, doing a 30-part series on TikTok to try to drum up this anxiety about what happened to Princess Kate. But, you know, the them part, the argument has been put forward, I think, pretty persuasively by people, including, I thought, a really good column in the Philadelphia Inquirer by Will Bunch, which basically says—
That's a great name.
Yeah, I know. Basically says, look, other people, you know, New York Times columnists, for instance, are using this as a real moralizing moment, shaking the finger at the collective mob and saying, how could you come up with such crazy stuff when this woman has been suffering? But actually, she is, as Nomi has pointed out, a very public person, and her entire job in life is to be a public person.
Yeah.
And so Kensington Palace, which runs the, you know, Prince and Princess of Wales business over there, should have understood that leaving this absolute absurd void, this vacuum lurking and saying, don't worry, in an incredible amount of symbolism to me, she'll pop up on Easter. Like, just have to wait till Easter for the second coming of Kate. She'll
be
there.
She has risen.
Yeah, no one's waiting for Easter, guys. And putting the ball into the public's court did them absolutely no favors. And to now, you know, roundly chastise the public is perhaps not as appropriate as might be thought.
That's right. So we're going to take a break, but when we do get back, I want to get a little bit more specific. Critics at Large from The New Yorker goes down the rabbit hole of elaborate online fictions. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
So the Kate Middleton saga is a recent, very conspicuous example of this kind of online behavior. But of course, it's not the first. So almost as we would do describing, I don't know,
a genre, right,
of art. I want to just talk about the definition of this kind of behavior. Or maybe the product of this kind of behavior. One, I will say, and maybe this is tonally, is—and you can hear it in those TikToks— an absolutely maniacal focus on building and then reading oneself into a body of evidence. This is a big part of it. It's
yes.
like—
Details.
These people, and you could call them conspiracy theorists, but they are also kind of—
Fans,
fantasy world builders, right? Mm-hmm. Crucially, they are always pointing to documents almost like, you know, a PhD would. Or somebody say, have you seen this? Have you seen, you know, Exhibit A?
There's a forensic element that you guys are talking about.
A forensic element, yes.
Right. Definitely forensic element. I mean, to me, there's also, like, we keep saying fan and fiction, but I'm just going to combine it and say fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what fan fiction is online, and that's also really an online medium, is taking a text, like a book written that everyone can read and the author has finished it to their liking, and spinning it out and taking the characters and making the characters do what you want them to do and kind of treating all of these things as fodder for your own creation. So I do think a version of that is going on here, with the characters being the very public royal family, and they are kind of perfect characters for this mm-hmm. because they are all about public-facing stuff, and we love to get glimpses into their private lives.
Right.
The allure of being kept out of the private world just makes the private world that much more enticing.
I think also another point, you know, if we're talking specifically about the celebrity versions of this, mm-hmm. right, this specific kind of thing that we identified with Kate, I think there's often a famous woman, kind of like a beautiful, vulnerable or perceived as vulnerable figure who has been through a lot, you know. So we're talking about Princess Kate, but let's talk about Britney Spears, you know, the most princess in a tower figure ever, you know. And what led to that and what's applicable for this discussion is the hashtag Free Britney movement.
And crucially, like, you know, part of that was people reading her Instagram posts for signs.
So like they did exactly what we're talking about.
That's right.
And the crazy thing was they were at least partly right. You know, she didn't want to be in this conservatorship. And so they were reading the smallest signs. They were like, she's wearing a yellow top. When she wears a yellow top,
it means
that she's trying to contact her fans and tell them things are not right, you know, or she's blinking, like, Britney, blink twice if you're okay, you know, stuff like that. And the crazy thing was she wasn't okay. And she did say that having the fans seeing those fan comments, whether they were completely right about the signs or not, gave her kind of the courage and the ability to break out of the situation she was in.
But I think this is important. This is another perhaps characteristic of this form of literature, let's call it, which is a correspondence between the authors of this fan fiction and the official sources of knowledge that are their sort of corollary. So in this case, the official source of knowledge is Britney.
Yeah.
She knows what she's trying to say.
Right.
And part of the action of the fan fiction is a decoding function. This has a corollary with Kate Middleton because, as you mentioned in your retelling of this, there was this bumbling sort of counterpoint by the palace.
The handling,
let's dole out information because they understand that the force of this fiction is so strong that they understand they need to meet it with something like
they have to manage
their forms of evidence. So let's give you a picture. Let's put out a statement that says this is what's happening. She'll be back by X. There's a partner in this fiction making, which is the official source.
You know, we often talk about this word parasociality.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes up more and more every day, because people have always, of course, you know, I am skeptical, like, don't need to go back to Henry VIII, but I'm always a little skeptical of we're seeing such and such for the first time. People have always projected onto idols, onto pop culture figures, onto figures in general, public figures in general, their own set of, you know, beliefs about what people are like or their own wishes for what people should be like. But of course, we do see a lot more of it now because it has to go both ways. Because the way to retain fans, followers, whatever it is in the modern attention economy is to seem to be engaging with them.
Mm-hmm.
You have to court that kind of attention and you have to court that kind of sense of closeness with a group of people who's interested in you.
So
you know, aloofness won't do.
Yeah. I mean, I think... Alex, I think that's really right. And like one thing that you guys know about me is that in the late aughts, I was a fact checker at Us Weekly magazine when print was still king.
Crucial Nomi lore, listeners.
Crucial lore. So this was like around 2008 or so, 2008, 2009. And so people were still reading magazines. You know, you'd have these pictures of like a new couple, a new celebrity couple. You know, like, I don't know, Justin Timberlake and Cameron Diaz or something. I'm trying to think, you know, Jennifer Garner and Ben Affleck, whatever. Those pictures would be published. And then one thing that Us Weekly would do, and I imagine other tabloids as well, they would call in a body language expert. I remember one specifically that was always used. Her name was Lillian Glass. And it would kind of be a sidebar on the page. And there was a picture, would be a picture of like, whatever, a couple at a Lakers game or something. And it would be like Lillian Glass coming in and saying, her hand is on his knee. This suggests that she offers him love and protection. Or her head is turned away from him. This suggests that she has, you know, no patience for his egotism or whatever, you know. And so basically she was doing the same thing that is now happening on a preposterously, you know, a much larger scale where people are getting their fodder straight from the source, usually, whether it's Instagram or like interviews, videos, TikToks of celebrities, mm-hmm. and analyzing it as a group, as a community.
Yeah. Now might be a good time to talk about, just to further illustrate this tendency, a book that we all read, mm-hmm. Naomi Klein's Doppelganger.
Yes.
A Trip into the Mirror World. Mm. First of all, I love the cover of this book. It's a picture of the writer Naomi Klein in this sort of like digitized.
She's in the Matrix.
She's kind of in the Matrix. That's right. But the book is about, it's mostly about the conspiracism and the tendency toward conspiracism that had its culmination in the sort of throes of COVID. And specifically about how Naomi Klein, a very sane and reasonable leftist writer who is most famously the author of the book The Shock Doctrine, she, during COVID, started to be more and more and more mistaken for another writer, Naomi Wolf, who you might know as the author of a book like The Beauty Myth.
Classic 90s work of feminism critiquing cultural standards of female beauty, yeah.
That's right. Who over time became a pretty livid conspiracy theorist.
Oh, yeah.
And a fountain of misinformation.
Anti-vaxxer.
You can, if you get the COVID vaccine, you can shed it.
Shed it and cause infertility in other women.
Yeah, she and Steve Bannon are pretty cozy these days, it seems.
Right.
She goes on his podcast a bunch, I gather.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think pretty artfully she talks, Naomi Klein talks about the idea of the doppelganger, the alternate, not just version of yourself, not just the alternate identity, but the sort of underbelly of a society mm-hmm. And its organs of information to create sort of a false world of information of the kind that we've been kind of talking about. Alex, what are your Naomi Klein thoughts? What are your doppelganger thoughts? And sort of how does it...
What are you doing with your eyebrows?
I'm just getting excited. I'm getting excited because we're entering the shadow world.
This is the shadow world. And it kind of is like what Naomi just talked about. It's like a whole society trying to perform body language analysis on like Dr. Fauci. You know?
Exactly. So, okay. Thing one. Again, I hate to be – well, I don't hate to be. Who am I kidding?
You are
– I absolutely love –
You are the book of Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new under the sun.
That's it. Vincent knows exactly where I'm going.
Oh, my goodness, you know me so well.
Yeah, I love to be that person, to be like, look at history.
And, from the dawn of time.
Well, one thing that I think is really interesting that Naomi Klein points out is how attracted we as humans are to this idea of the double. I can't actually remember if she mentions this, but it's a cultural phenomenon that's on my mind because I remember becoming aware of it when I was much younger, which is the Paul is dead situation with Paul McCartney and the Beatles. This idea that, and again, exactly what you're talking about, Vincent. Oh, look at the cover of Abbey Road. Paul is the only one not wearing shoes. If you play whichever record backwards, you're going to hear Paul is dead.
Paul is dead now. Miss him.
Yes. Right.
That made a huge impression.
Yes.
So, on young me.
Yeah. And I think the idea is, first of all, it privileges this idea that you might be the one to perceive the truth, that the rest of the people out there are sheep. And I do think this is very important for a conspiratorial thinking, that you have the truth revealed to you. You know, so what makes our current era different? One thing that Naomi Klein says that I really love is that in the digital world, we all have doubles. We all are doubles. If you go on any site and you say, I'm going to make a social media profile, already your double exists.
You have created your own double.
You have created your own double, and you have to kind of feed that double and maintain that double. Your double is important both for the way other people perceive you mm-hmm. because – many more people may encounter your online version than you can possibly encounter in the course of your regular embodied social life. And also, it becomes this capitalistic necessity. Mm-hmm. If you want to get your, quote, brand out there,
you
better be pushing your double. The idea that she's talking about now in Doppelganger is, okay, so we've all become a version of the corporation where we have to, or it seems like to thrive in under current digital capitalism, we are all supposed to be maintaining this consistent logo, this consistent brand for who we are. And she says, this is a quote from the book, good branding is an exercise in discipline and repetition. It means knowing exactly where you are headed all the time, which is essentially in concentric circles. So that to me describes what Kate Middleton's position is.
Right.
Like, she is supposed to be on brand all the time. God forbid she get off brand and have an actual crisis that requires her to show a different side of herself or need to absent herself from this kind of, you know, feeding of her other reality, her feeding of her avatar, which is like the person we all see all the time. Mm-hmm. So that happened to her. In other words, she had like a human experience and had to be a slightly different person for a while. And the world can't tolerate it.
Yeah. The other thing that like really struck me about it was Klein does something that I do often. And it's so refreshing to hear that someone else does this, which is just feed herself a bunch of shit content like a pig at a trough. She's just like, I'm going to watch every Steve Bannon podcast.
Yeah.
And like, if you got listeners, if you know the podcast that I listen to, you might not listen to this.
Oh,
it
no.
Just because there is a kind of coherence in this worldview that doesn't even exist in life, that is so addictive to hear somebody explain something from A to Z. Sometimes you got to do this, right? But so as she reads herself into this literature, one thing that she starts to realize and kind of admits is that the medical establishment could have done certain things better. For
example,
not immediately sort of pillory and make a sort of joke out of, for example, the lab leak theory of the origins of the virus. You know, that there were questions that could have been sort of more artfully explored and left open. But of course, the impulse to fight fire with fire, to fight conjecture with a kind of certainty, creates more room for, you know, this kind of
suspicion, rhetorical
chicanery. That's right.
Yeah.
The ability of the sort of rumor, of the conjecture, of the projection, right? The ability of that element to create texts that have to be reckoned with. Not just, you know, bodies of thought or whatever, but real, you know, people started to say, do your own research. I've done my own research. And the reason that that could be said was that there was, you could go to a website and read a whole document with footnotes and everything, you know, in a way that I do think is genuinely new and depends on the sort of crowdsourcing function of the internet. There are true bodies of quote unquote knowledge that one can read oneself into and hopefully, you know, God, you know, hopefully out of as well. In a minute, we'll look at the conspiratorial impulse, where it's been, where it's going, and what are the stakes for the future. Much like a conspiracist on the case, we're going to get to the bottom of it. Right here.
Finally.
Let's go to the evidence.
That's right.
Hello there, radio listeners. It's Luke Burbank, host of LiveWire. Each week, we bring you riveting and unexpected conversations with the people behind some of the most interesting entertainment and culture out there today. Plus, we're going to introduce you to great music and outrageously funny comedy. And you get to hang with me and our announcer, Elena Passarello, as we talk about the best news of the week. So please, don't miss LiveWire.
Something about conspiratorial thinking that I've been thinking about is, first of all, it uniquely combines this sense of personal perspective with collective perspective. I've had insight into something that goes against the official channels. I don't believe what I'm being told. They're not telling us the right thing. So I and others who see like I do, which becomes the we, can reveal the truth. Mm-hmm. There is a nobleness to that, if you want to put it like on one end of the spectrum. There's a narcissism to it, if you want to put it on another end. And what happens when that kind of independent mindset becomes groupthink. I mean, frankly, this sense of originality and the sense of going against the grain actually leads to something very unoriginal and very predictable. There's a great essay that, Vincent, I know you've read as well, Richard Hofstadter's The Paranoid Style in American Politics, which was published in Harper's in
1964.
Right,
1964. And it became then the title of a book of Hofstadter's essays and has become quite influential as a reading of certain strands of right-wing thought in American politics.
Totally. I mean, I think the Hofstadter essay should kind of be mandatory reading for every American, kind of every person, because it traces what he calls a paranoid style, which is this idea of seeing conspiracy everywhere.
That's right.
Back in American history, back to the 18th century, looking at the Illuminati through anti-Catholic movements in the 19th century, through the anti-communist purge that he had just seen in the 50s. But you can, you know, as he says, it's not just the right wing that is subject to this. Like, we all have certain tendencies of this kind of paranoid thinking, which means that we can blow up certain signs or certain ideas and immediately cross over into what Naomi Klein calls the mirror world, into this fantasy world. And when you read an essay that kind of says, look, it's happened here, it's happened then, you understand it to be a historical pattern that takes the originality out of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think this often happens when there's a lack of trust in institutions, right? Mm-hmm. The kind of destruction of institutions and the public belief in them. And, you know, when we were preparing this episode, I was thinking about I recently watched a couple of movies from the 70s. Mm-hmm. A few months ago, I watched The Parallax View from 1974, starring Warren Beatty, and I watched Cutter's Way actually a couple of weeks ago from 1981, but it's still kind of like the long 70s.
The long 70s.
Yeah. Basically, it's about like shadowy institutions that have some form of power, be it the government, be it a corporation, which are hiding something. You know, they're hiding a public menace, whether it's, you know, environmental, or whether it's like literally they're assassinating people, they're assassinating kind of enemies of the state.
If you want to use the FBI or the CIA, you don't have to infiltrate the whole agency to do it. At first, I thought these killings were related only to the Carroll assassination. It's much bigger than that. Whoever's behind this is in the business of recruiting assassins.
Recruiting assassins?
Hmm. I think I got some of their entrance exams. If I'm right, I'm going to enlist. If you print anything now, I'll be exposed.
You're telling me that you alone can uncover what all these agencies couldn't.
Maybe. I'm just asking you not to print anything or talk about this.
This is post-Vietnam. Mm-hmm. It's post-Watergate, you know, for the most part. The country is in crisis. Nobody is happy with whoever's leading us. You know, the economy sucks. And one thing that I thought of was interesting in relation to what we've been discussing is that this is like a lone actor, these movies.
Absolutely.
Right? Or maybe sometimes two friends, right? But it's like, it's not a community. It's not like
they're in on it. And they have to go it alone if they're going to bring down the big...
They're not like sitting on the internet being like, hey, look, guys, the angle of this bullet is like weird. You know, oh, this waiter is actually not a waiter. He's an assassin.
Right.
And he's CIA. You know, it's like that's the kind of animating energy behind these like paranoid thrillers of the 70s. Whereas we're talking about kind of a later revolution in this impulse.
Oh, yeah, that's a great point, Naomi. I mean, it's very David and Goliath in those 70s movies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one thing that maybe is going on now with some of these conspiracy theories is the internet provides an interesting double illusion and a paradoxical illusion. One, that, you're up against these big forces, but two, that you are legion.
Right.
Like, you can be David and Goliath at the same time, it almost seems like. And I do think in the political realm, a lot depends on continuing to make people who feel this way feel disempowered. This is another point that Hofstadter makes, that feeling disempowered is often a pretty key part of the paranoid state of mind. And not to always point back to Trump, but I think he's very good at keeping that in the balance. Yeah.
And at one of the strengths of this form of thinking, and I think Trump is very good at it and so is Steve Bannon, is to take advantage of how much that whole structure is a kind of parody of, like, the rhetoric of the American Revolution.
Yes.
You know, it's like, this is why they always call themselves patriots, you know, because it's a reiteration of...
It's the founding, it's
the
spirit
crown
of
is against
founding.
Us. And they're
yes.
We're asking questions. Right. We're asking questions and lodging our complaints, as just as we did at King George, right? It's like... all of this adds up to a situation that is very much in our cultural DNA, right? Can I read something from the Hofstadter?
Please.
I think to sort of like talk about what kind of literature we're talking about. He says, I love this part of the, it's like maybe the penultimate section of the essay. He says, a final characteristic of the paranoid style is related to the quality of its pedantry. One of the impressive things about paranoid literature is the contrast between its fantasied conclusions and the almost touching concern with factuality it invariably shows. It produces heroic strivings for evidence to prove that the unbelievable is the only thing that can be believed.
Yeah, it goes right back to what you were saying at the start about Kate Middleton and this idea that people can compile the evidence, which they did pretty effectively to show that something else was going on than what was being put out there. Yeah, I mean, I feel like we're, not to be too pessimistic, I think it's only going to get more extreme and more difficult because the evidence that people can call into question, first of all, there's a proliferation of it because in the digital world, there's a proliferation of everything. And second of all, there's an increasing ability to manufacture it very skillfully.
Yes.
I mean,
deepfakes,
the bad Photoshop AI. On the Kate Middleton photo is touching.
It's touching.
It's touching because it is going to be a relic. It's touching that they could be, you know, such simpletons, really, whoever did that
like
and put it out.
Like a cut and paste, you know, collage with like scissors and,
exactly.
and glue.
Yeah, because we are really looking at a world in which, you know, we've already had many experiments with like literal AI doppelgangers showing up and, you know, looking like, wasn't there that press conference where a doppelganger of Putin played Putin and asked him a question to his own face?
Yeah, an AI doppelganger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, where does that leave us, guys?
Yeah, so that's the question.
Yeah, I don't
is
know.
There, in any of the, you know, whether it's Hofstadter or whether it's Naomi Klein, is there any antidote to this? It seems like institutions themselves, in so many cases, have only, in trying to tamp down the fire of this mode, have only sort of helped it become a conflagration. Like, is there an antidote that we see to this?
I'm scared.
Well, I would say, I mean, I've drawn a couple of conclusions, and I don't know if they're antidotes, but in thinking with you guys through all of this stuff, one is just, you know, good old Occam's razor. Like, I think that is kind of what happened with the Kate Middleton story. Like, the simplest explanation is probably the right explanation, I think, is the best way to summarize Occam's razor. There's a kind of humility to Occam's razor thinking that I don't know if it can be pushed onto to the large scale, because humility is by definition a small scale phenomenon. It requires
That's
you to
right.
think smaller rather than bigger.
I think also what Naomi Klein points out, or maybe enacts, maybe the whole book is a way of illustrating this perhaps principle, which is that the rest of us who are not maybe as conspiratorial in bent could spend more time looking at those conspiracies. I think it's so dark and so sordid, but there is a certain, just as we, you know, advocate a certain kind of literacy through this podcast, it's like reading our way into these things, not enough to be radicalized by them, but to understand what like a troubling number of our fellows at any moment sort of believe is a kind of tonic action. And can make us less sort of...
It's like a vaccine.
That's right. It's like a vaccine.
Just a touch of poison.
That's right. That's a good point.
Yeah. Well, I was reading an article last week in the New York Times by Kevin Roos about how Reddit really succeeded because of content moderation, which is actually, just if you want to talk in practical terms about where these things thrive, really interesting, you know. And actually, like, it's pretty relevant because Reddit has just gone public to the tune of, you know, $1 billion+.
Yeah.
And the populism of the internet revolts against content moderation. Mm-hmm. No, no. Like, let the cream rise to the top. Let us say what we want. Don't censor us.
Right.
And Reddit really, unlike certainly Elon Musk's Twitter.
That's right.
And unlike a lot of, you know, Facebook and other platforms, really went hard into moderation and said, no, actually, if really vile lies are allowed to spread, we're going to get rid of them. And more than lies, just some really bad stuff going on there. And that was successful. Mm. So
I like that.
I know. I think, like, if you want one little bit of optimism, it's that it can – the truth, not always, but sometimes can be known.
Content mods, this app is for you.
Yeah. We're sorry for what you go through.
Shout out to the mods. So before we go – a heads up. Next week is an episode we've been planning for a while, and I think we're all really looking forward to it. We're talking about the writer, Patricia Highsmith, and specifically about her novel, The Talented Mr. Ripley. There's a new Netflix adaptation coming out starring Andrew Scott. The Hot Priest.
Oh, The Hot Priest.
The Hot Priest from Fleabag as Tom Ripley. I will admit that before our planning for this, I had never known these books.
You guys are going to love it.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
So good.
Awesome. So maybe, listeners, maybe this will be your first stroll down that lane. We're giving you a week to sort of read along with us.
And we're also going to talk about Saltburn, because it has a lot of Ripley-esque echoes.
I can't wait. It's going to be,
oh God,
as I called it on my letterbox, catnip for sickos.
We'll discuss.
This has been Critics at Large. Our senior producer is Rhiannon Corby, and Alex Barish is our consulting editor. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Condé Nast's head of global audio is Chris Bannon. Alexis Quadrado composed our theme music, and we had engineering help today from Jake Loomis, with mixing by Mike Kutchman. You can find every episode of Critics at Large at newyorker.com/critics, and you can email us at themail@newyorker.com with the subject line, Critics. See you next Thursday.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.